Welcome to The Creative Shift. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. So today I have a really fascinating conversation with Tad Hargrave. Tad and I have known each other online for years, and he's got this really interesting background when it comes to marketing and sales. So I've come to know him through his site, marketingforhippies.com. And he, he primarily focuses his work on serving, I believe what he calls holistic practitioners. And so for one, he comes to this from a really interesting standpoint because he's working with people whose role is to, I believe, essentially heal other people, to really work with other people. Beyond that, in his, I'll say, earlier life, he had worked for a franchise of Tony Robbins. And in the interview, he talks about how he learned kind of sales from Tom Hopkins and Brian Tracy and Zig Ziglar. And I always thought that was interesting because I think that when you get into a really serious conversation about what is marketing, what is sales, there is that tension that we talk about between wanting to feel a sense of authenticity and comfort and a feeling down to earth and a sense of connection and helping people. Then we want to find things that are effective and have high return on investment, and that always feels distant and confusing. And then the third thing in the Venn diagram of marketing is our nearly constant experience with marketing that turns us off, seeing people who are being too predatory, or they are, you know, doing all these things to try to market to you, and it feels wrong. It feels off in some way. We dig into all of this in this interview, and I really loved really having such an honest conversation with Tad about this. We dig into a lot of the psychological triggers behind marketing and why they work, why they don't work. We explore some alternatives to these as well. I think a really big theme in the conversation is how to feel good about marketing. How can you take something that you might feel is negative or is confusing or is distant from you, and how to make it something that feels fulfilling? So this is a really fun conversation. It digs into marketing, I think, in a very analytical way. There's a lot in here that I think will be actionable for writers and artists as well. Here is my conversation with Tad Hargrave. Hey, everyone. This is Dan Blank. I'm very excited to be chatting with Tad Hargrave. Welcome.
Good to be here.
All right. I'm really excited to chat. And you and I have connected off and on over the years, and I always think you have such a compelling way that you talk about marketing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of different questions that I really honestly for myself want to ask you because I think you've got such a great take on things. But I figure, you know, I tend to speak to writers and artists, and you have a related audience, but also a little different. And I guess the first question is a little bit broad, but I think that one that a lot of people think about, which is when people think about the idea of marketing, what do they get wrong? What are the misconceptions that sort of stop them right away from really even understanding the power of it or how to find a way into it that would be fruitful for them?
In permaculture, they talk about this idea of a type zero error, where it's like you put the solar panel on the north side of your house, or you build your house in the floodplains, and no matter what you do on top of that, it just compounds the initial error. What are those things that, if those are in place, no matter what you do next, you know, screws up the rest of the things? And the first thing that came to mind as you were speaking is they think they should be good at it. And this is something that literally just hit me in the last year. And I've said it at workshops, and I can see everyone's shoulders just drop, like the relief. I just put out the most, so what if you're supposed to be terrible at marketing your stuff? And they kind of sit back, because it's true. Everyone's terrible at marketing their own stuff. People tend to be shy. I think millions of years of evolution in hunter-gatherer society where you're not supposed to stand out has not been rewired yet. You see little kids hiding behind their parents. When we go to a networking event, it's just a strange situation to be there to promote yourself. And so a lot of people just don't. They just, you know, quietly drink themselves into oblivion in the corner by themselves, saying, why couldn't I just be at home reading a book right now? But so then what I offer people is I said, look, let's just accept that you're terrible at this and that you will only ever become slightly better and slightly less awkward. But the punchline of this is, and I say, guess who's really good at marketing you? The people who love your work. So then what does marketing become? Marketing becomes making it easy for people to share about you. Marketing becomes a few things. And then, you know, also this, so that's one. And then connected to that is this, this idea that marketing is about getting your name out there and getting, and I don't think that's true. I think marketing is about getting their name in here, you know. So the difference between going to a networking event and you give out 100 business cards and you feel so proud of yourself, but of course nothing happens from it, nobody calls, versus you got 10 people's cards and you follow up with them to see where there might be a fit. You know, this is a different thing. And another one is this idea that you're trying to find clients. And this, it's not, I don't want to be dogmatic about this because multiple things can be true, but I think people lean very heavily on this crutch of I'm trying to find clients. But what if actually marketing was about making it easy for clients to find you, because they're already looking for you? You know, there are people who are, you know, for authors, you know, there are people who are looking for books on particular things, and we all know the feeling when you find a book that's exactly on the topic. It's exactly the kind of story you're looking for from the exact perspective, and you just almost want to cry. Like, there's, this is exactly the thing. So people are looking. People are browsing. People go to bookstores, and they go to a certain section in the bookstore. They go to a certain, you know, they have certain authors, and when they pick up the books, or even who reviewed it. I remember this book by this guy, Frank McEwen, called The Mist-Filled Path. I was, you know, getting into Celtic spirituality, and I go to that section of the bookstore, and I pulled out a book, and it was reviewed by John and Caitlin Matthews, who are big names, and Julia Butterfly, who was a friend of mine. Like all these, and I loved every single person who reviewed it. So I thought, oh, this is, and it was wonderful.
So just to slow it down a bit here, because there's a lot of, as I always want to think too, like the practical parts of what you're saying, and there's a lot in here. And the one, I mean, the first thing is the idea of being findable. And I think it's a way of a lot of people look at social media and they're afraid of that shameless self-promotion, but some of it too is just that, well, you're showing up and that makes us able to find you. And I look at author websites and social media platforms all the time where nothing is connected. And they're really active on Instagram. It's not on their website. There's no link on their Instagram to their website. Their website has not been updated in 3 years and it's talking about the wrong book. Where it's like even the basics of knowing how to communicate what you care about is a part of it. And then another thing you kind of said in there is instead of thinking about it as joining social media to talk about you, just flip it. Use it to talk about other people. Think about how many reviews you can get for other people's books this week, that sort of a thing.
Yeah, you know, and social media can be a chance to talk about what we care about. And of course, the business or whatever we're writing about or talking about, that's part of it. But we care about more things than that. And I'll tell you what, I got an offer from some colleagues of mine in the Bay Area to co-author a book with them about green business. It never happened. But and we'd never met in person. They based this entirely on what I posted on Facebook. Because I didn't just post self-promotion stuff. I also posted stuff about, you know, green sustainability, all this. But yeah, so we want to make it easy for people to share the word about us. We want to make it easy for people to find us. And we want to make it safe for them to approach us. Because I think this is the other thing, you know, it's the default people go into is, well, I don't want to be pushy, but wait, why would you be pushy? Well, because I have to approach them but wait, why do you have to approach them? And so then if we make it easy for them to find us, if we make it and that's safe for them to approach us, this just starts to turn everything around in marketing. You know, and the other thing I'll throw in is, and this was the big one for me, because I worked for a Tony Robbins franchise. He had franchises back in the day. And I learned sales from Tom Hopkins, Zig Ziglar, Brian Tracy, all the, you know, the old crowd. And the explicit in that sales training is the point of selling is to get the sale. That's the whole goal. And how do you know you succeeded? You got the sale. How do you know you failed? You didn't get the sale, period. And there was a guy, Ari Galper. He has a website, unlockthegame.com. And a beautiful guy. And he had a thing. It was originally called reverse selling. And his thing was, what if the reason that there's all this sales pressure is because of the language we use and the mindset we have in sales, and that it triggers this in people. It triggers the salesperson reaction and it creates this defensiveness. And what if the core, the heart of the mindset that causes the troubles is that we're going for the sale versus as a covert agenda, not spoken about, versus an overt agenda to get to the truth of is it a fit?
See, that triggers me where some of those fascinating people I can remember meeting are professional salespeople. People who, this is their job, and they work in normal companies. Because I'm thinking of a couple that I used to work with at a big media company, and they were fascinating because they had what you just said. They were so down to earth. They were so nice. They were so inquisitive. And I'm on the same team with them, so they have nothing to sell me. But they just really cared. And I'd watch them at work. I'd watch them. And they were just very good at connecting with people on a human level. They were good at actually caring about what's going on in that person's job or outside the job. They really seemed to understand how to nurture a relationship. And of course, getting a sale was a part of their job. But I remember talking to one of them and just me saying, like, I'm just so fascinated by what you do. It's just the way they do it. And they said the same thing back to me, which was nice. It was just interesting seeing that. But what was so fascinating was that, of course, the sale is a part of it, but the way they went about it had a real sense of humanness and of caring to it and whatever it is you just said. I'm not sure if you've experienced that too, where there's sort of the good end of it, you know, and then there's end of it where people kind of, they miss that part of it.
Yeah, it's, well, and there's a short term, there's a short game versus a long game. And the short game, yeah, use all the tactics. I mean, Simon Sinek in his book, Start With Why, I think one of the very first parts he says is, it's like, I can't say the tactics don't work. Because of course they do. But, you know, I'll give a story that illustrates the short versus long game. Okay, so here's the short game. A friend of mine, a colleague in England, he was a part of these big rah-rah Tony Robbins type sales seminars where everyone gets an hour, and of course they're pitching their home study courses on stage, and that's most of their presentation, frankly. So, but at the end of the day, let's say it's about $1 million in sales, you know, it's a huge numbers. And so that's the short game, because you look at that and you say, well, I saw how many people ran to the back. That's a $30,000 mentorship program, and they ran to the back. I saw them process their credit card. I'm doing the math. That's $1 million. How can you not say that's success? Okay, that's the short game. And by metrics, you'd have to say successful. The next day, 90% of people call and ask for a refund, 90. Almost everybody calls and asks for a refund. So that's the long game. And then let's extend that long game further when they talk to their friends and say, God, I can't believe how worked I got. You know, that was so manipulative. And they start, that word of mouth spreads. And what about then? What about just the consequence on their spouse who said, how much? And the tension that brings to the relationship. But he said there was one, it was four men, one woman. Said the woman, her pitch wasn't really aggressive and her sales were less, but so was the refund rate, dramatically less. And so, you know, George Cao, one of my colleagues, he said, one of the questions we should ask with every marketing tactic is, what would be the impact on the marketplace if everyone did this tactic?
Oh, that's interesting.
Because if everyone, you know, I remember I was dating a woman and she was at a cafe, started a conversation with another woman, and they got along really well, just a short couple of minutes. The woman said, do you want to go for coffee sometime? So they go for coffee. About 5 minutes into that coffee date, it's an Amway presentation. I mean, literally the folder comes out and here's a business opportunity for you. So it was the bait and switch. And she felt so betrayed by the whole thing. And so then what if everyone did that? I'll tell you what would happen. Nobody would ever go for coffee again. You know, strangers, because, and it's the same thing where come to my free intro workshop. And when I was in Amsterdam doing a quick aside story, one day I get an email, somebody saying, somebody ripped off your website in Amsterdam. and in the Netherlands. And like, sure enough, marketingvoorhippies.nl had been created. And she said, you wouldn't know because you don't speak Dutch. But the about page, like the about the business, is your page word for word translated into Dutch. Anyways, I emailed the guy and I said, this is not cool. You can't do this. I can't. I'm not going to sue you. And but I would win if I did. And anyways, he just dropped it. He said, yeah, hey, I didn't think you'd ever come here. I was only going to keep it local.
I just thought it was a name. Oh, it's horrible.
I know. But as I said, look, I'm okay. I get it. You know, we all make mistakes in business. And when I start, I probably copied a lot of copywriting. And so it's no problem. So next time, I do plan to come to Amsterdam. And when I come, let's go for beers. And so we did. We went to Café Noorderlicht in northern Amsterdam. And then we – and I did a workshop there. Had 60 people. And guess who hosted it? Was that guy. So it all works out, you know.
Well, it's a neat way to flip it and think, well, this is someone who resonated with your message, a little misguided in terms of tactics, but that there's a seed there that is worth kind of nurturing. It, there's a couple things you hit upon there. You use the word tension. And that reminds me a lot of how people see marketing happen online. And, you know, with the example of selling the courses at these seminars, it reminds me a lot of how I've seen the online course ecosystem kind of come up and evolve over the years, which I was relatively early to it when I started my company a decade ago. And I saw, obviously, it just skyrocketed from there. And you saw a lot of people come in, a lot of pressure, you know, really... interesting training as part of it, and then a lot of charisma, and then all the countdown timers and the bonuses, and the price is going up next year, and this is the last time I'm offering them, all this kind of stuff. And it makes me think about that aspect where tension often is a part of how we buy things. And that can be really bad, because the flip side of a lot of the course is that you're getting a lot of content and no support. So it's not bad. It might not even be a bad deal, but like those people rush the back of the room, they might be so excited to ease that tension, but they haven't really found time or energy in their schedule to take the course. So they're not getting results, and that creates a different kind of tension.
Now, when you say tension, by the way, tension between what do you think in terms of the selling part of it?
I guess some of what I'm thinking of is fear of missing out, that idea that if, and you see this a lot where it happens to me all the time. If I'm booking a vacation on Airbnb and they say one other person is, you know, three other people are looking at this page right now. Or if I'm looking at Reverb.com, which sells used musical equipment, you know, two other people have this guitar in their cart. If I'm on Amazon, it says, you know, 20 more, only 20 more left. Yeah. It definitely reframes the narrative in my head, which is not just, do I need it, to, oh my gosh, am I going to miss out on it? And that is a different emotional feeling right there.
Yeah. Well, so there are two thoughts I have about this. One is that, I mean, I just did a video. Maybe this was the video we connected on, but the scarcity one, was that it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just that, so just a short recap on it, but the scarcity is a real thing. The world is full of scarce things, and it's an ethical thing to let people know when something's scarce, and it's unethical to pretend it's scarce when it isn't. So that's the first thing. I mean, you know, it's like De Beers and the diamonds thing. They're not so scarce as they make out, but they control the supply, and so make it seem scarce. Or, yeah, I remember a countdown timer where it was the... Yeah, like 18 hours left. I thought, and that's, I should act on this or read it now. And then I refreshed the page for some reason, and the countdown timer started again. You know, there's not such a thing as a limited number of ebooks. So unless there is a reason, you might say, I'm releasing this because I want feedback, and before I sell it, I'd like some reviews. So if you get this at this price, I'm offering it cheaper because I want your, you know, that's fair. Anyways, it's just good to be clear about that. And the second piece with this is the filtering piece. So, you know, in my understanding with marketing, there's three roles of marketing. First role is to get their attention. Second role is to filter. And the third is to lower the risk of them taking the next step. So getting the attention is mostly word of mouth is how that works. That's how it actually happens in the world primarily.
Isn't that – just want to pause and not want you to forget, lose your place, but – I feel like that's scary for people to hear, because word of mouth is a type of thing that, I mean, this is how I've thought about my head, which is it's hard to, when you really feel like now's the time, there's not a lot of levers to press or buttons to push. It's the type of thing that you would have to have developed over a long period of time in a lot of nuanced ways. And that freaks people out, because it sounds like, well, if they haven't done the work, that they're behind. A lot of people feel that way regardless. And then two, they just wonder, are they going to be able to do the work?
Yes. Okay. So I would say to hone that a bit, word of mouth is the long game in marketing. That's the sustainable approach. That's the one that doesn't burn you out. There is also such a thing, you know, I wrote this piece 8 years ago called Slow Marketing. Just put it up on Medium again. And that's the basis of marketing, is this slow relationship building, organic word of mouth approach. But there is such a thing as fast marketing. There's a time for hustle. There's a time where you push the buttons, you pull the levers, and there are things you can do. I mean, I have the whole course, the meantime I do once a year, that's all about this. And there's like 36 specific tactics you can do. And it's not a sustainable approach. I mean, there's a time for hustle, and it's proper, you know, and then this is not a new capitalist thing, you know, make hay when the sun shines. There's just a season for certain things. Okay, literally the sun is shining. We have to get out there, because if we don't today. So yeah, life is full of those things. And the long game is a reputation. The long game is that, you know, and then word of mouth comes down to three things fundamentally. One, the first, the most important, 90% of it is that you're really good at what you do. You're good at your craft. You know, if you're a healer, people get better. If you're a mechanic, the car works. If you're an author, your writing is good. If the quality of what you do is no good, and that's why people spread the word. You go to a restaurant and say, that was the most incredible meal. The service was remarkable. When it's mediocre, no one talks about it. If it's really bad or really good, people do.
Is that true? And I'm playing devil's advocate on this, but I'm asking very honestly, because I can think of every field has not just one or two examples, but a lot of examples. You know, the author who people feel like this writing is bad and they kind of copied, they even said they copied the idea, or, you know, a band or musician where they're the 14th copy of a more legendary act and they went ballistic, where the artist who is, again, it's like, oh my gosh, it's like they just took Escher and they just added this or whatever. And I've heard other people talk about more eloquently than I even just tried to, this idea that sometimes things that are not the highest quality do seem to spread for other reasons. And sometimes it's just moment, sometimes likability, sometimes packaging. And I think all of us maybe know people, like if you go to Nashville, I mean, I've never been, but I imagine you walk into every store, every bar, and there are just these amazing musicians, and they're trying to pay rent somehow. And then you'll turn on the radio and some guitarist without 1/10 of their skill is just doing great. Nothing against that guitarist. It's just something I'm always thinking about with that. I don't know if that's a question, but I'm just something I want to explore a little bit.
Yeah, it does stimulate some thoughts. Okay, so
I'm sorry, I keep taking you off on a tangent of a tangent, so I will apologize to you up front and the audience as well.
I'm keeping track, dude.
Thank you.
So, again, short game versus long game. This is part of it. And to remember, long game lasts more than your life. So, Van Gogh, not popular in his time, and now considered to be one of the greatest painters who ever lived. There's a lot of that. People who were not celebrated in their life, it took people longer. They were ahead of their time. There's just that quality often can take a while to be recognized. There's Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla. You know, I mean, I don't know the history very well, but as the story goes, Tesla was a bigger genius in the science, but Edison was a bigger genius in terms of marketing and in terms of kind of building teams and harnessing the ideas of other people. So different things, you know, and of course now Tesla's, you know, people I think are going back to his stuff and seeing how right he was about a lot of, so there's that.
So it's the idea that even the metrics by which we measure could be wrong. So if I'm giving examples of this one became a bestseller, this guy went, viral, it's like, yeah, and there's a different timeline for everyone. So the quote-unquote better musician might have taken them another 19 years, and they succeeded in a different way, but they still succeeded. And it's just matters about the measurement.
Yeah, so there's that. There's just what time frame are we even considering? What are we considering the metrics of success? And, you know, even the people who become very famous, it's sometimes we're looking at like, well, do you want that life?
Yeah.
You be the famous one, because it seems real good from the outside, but now you're touring constantly, you're never at home, you have no sense of belonging or community, there's the drugs, there's the partying, there's the wear and tear of the road, there's the, you know,
it sounds like the typical author life. I'm joking, but I know what you mean, which is sometimes people, they don't know what they want.
Yeah, you know, Leonard Cohen famously said so they don't pay you to play, they pay you to travel.
Oh, wow. I never heard that.
So there's that to consider, too. And there's such a thing as it being good to eat food and pay rent. And so, but then, you know, there's also this question of some people jump into business prematurely, and it would be better, you know, I mean, T.S. Eliot was a banker and kept his job, but wrote these masterpieces. There's a lot of people, and artists and authors in particular, who just kept their jobs and wrote on the side, and that worked well. And what's wrong with that? You know, that's just as legitimate a model as like trying to go full-time and be paid for the damn thing. And I could say that of life coaches, healers. I know a guy who does massage, and he just does it for friends. And it's free. That's his gift to the world. And he drives a FedEx truck, and he loves it. He loves driving the FedEx truck. There's also, let's just say this, there's such a thing as luck. There is such a thing as people being in the right place at the right time, and you have 10 equally skilled people, and one of them just gets a lucky break. There's such a thing as people then making good choices along the way that's put them in those positions. And, you know, just on a personal level, professional level, people make really bad decisions, and of course that's going to hurt them.
You know, that's something I think about a lot, and just want to pause on it, because I watch so many documentaries about writers and musicians and performers, and it's always that moment where the moment that Ozzy Osbourne met the guitarist, or that John met Paul and the beat, or whoever, and you think about how fragile that moment is, that this moment happened, that if it didn't, we wouldn't have maybe music that you love, or a movie or a book that you love. But then sometimes you also watch these and you see how tenacious these people are. And back your mind is sort of like, yeah, like if the Beatles hadn't gotten together, John Lennon probably wouldn't just be some English teacher somewhere. I don't know what he'd be doing, but something probably would have happened. And you get that sense too. And of course, no one knows, but it is an interesting thing to think about. I like that.
Yeah, so all of this is there. I mean, there are so many factors: luck, tenacity, and then there's also, you know, let's say with musicians or authors, there's such a thing as charisma. You know, like if you're a musician, well, great, you're technically, on a technical level, you're a better guitarist, but this person puts on a better show, and that's what people are paying for. You know, I think about this guy. What is his name? Roper. Something Roper, R-O-P-E-R. Anyways, he's a phenomenal guitarist, but the level of charisma he has, the level of ability he has, I've seen him just destroy crowds, just pandemonium, ecstasy from this guy, just because he just brings this happiness as he's playing, and this joy, anyways, so that's part of what people are paying for. So people make the mistake if they say, but it's like I do magic, close-up magic, yeah. And people will say, but I'm a better magician. Yeah, and you're socially awkward as hell. So there's that, you know. Your patter is terrible. Your persona is wooden. There was a guy, Fitzy, he's a magician. He wrote a book called this trilogy about showmanship. And it's, his books are just as true today, where he's said, I'm so tired of seeing magicians doing the exact same presentation, this wooden presentation. And he said, most of what the magic is showmanship. It's not the technical move. I mean, yes, you have to be technically good, but people will, I've seen people who, we call them in magic finger flickers, you know, because they're so good technically with their skill, or the magician's magician. Because they're so good. Other magicians know what they're seeing, so they admire the skill. But this is the downside of magic is, if I do a move that's real good, like with juggling, it's on display, but with magic, it's hidden. So it's real frustrating. Like, I just did something so hard. See it. Oh, man, I practiced that for years. And it doesn't matter, because what the audience is paying for, from a marketing standpoint, is a show. They want a show. And I think that you can translate to a lot of different things. And people mistake what people are buying. They think, oh, well, people are buying somebody who's really technically good.
That's such a huge point. And I'd love to talk about charisma a bit more, because I look at this in so many ways, the ways that you're talking about, where there's this effervescent thing that someone has. And well, you just said they have charisma. They, whatever it is, and charisma comes in all kinds of forms, the shy, vulnerable kind, the super deep kind, the funny, crazy kind, and everything in between. And it's neat when you see that, and it's sort of, you're right, it allows everything else to slip away. People criticize people like that, and you're like, yeah, but they get it done, and people love it, and that's why they're very successful. With marketing, I also see charisma working sometimes the other way. There are a lot of people I've seen who are very charismatic, and I mean that in the best sense of the word. They have a way of presenting their ideas and their material. And it's what in my head, I don't know if this is a phrase, it might be like charisma marketing, where it's a little bit what you described with that, the vent where someone's on stage and they're very charismatic, and then it gets people boiled up and they go running to the room. And it's a part of this. And the thing I always think about is are they leading someone somewhere? And where is sometimes charisma or likability misused? And it's a really weird gray line, because I've seen people who I thought had really overbearing marketing funnels. But if anyone on social media at all ever criticized them, even in a very light way, there'd be droves of people defending that person. You know, you don't get it, man. You don't get it. And it's like a weird sort of spell that's cast with people where I'm like, the person is not doing anything wrong, and they are very charismatic, but they're also really pushing people to sell, you know, into buying, and make them feel bad if they don't buy. And it's then you're in this funnel where now you're buying the next thing. And if you're not, it's just, I'm not sure what the question is, but how do you see charisma fitting into marketing in maybe a sometimes negative way? You just give a very positive example.
Yeah. Okay. So here's, I had a aunt who's in my mentorship program, and she went to a workshop. It was a women's entrepreneurship kind of workshop. And the woman who was leading, very charismatic on the stage, and she went in saying to herself, I am not going to sign up for the coaching package. She met another woman, and they swore to each other. Yeah. They became blood sisters and just not going to buy, and they both bought. And I don't care, you know, my client wants to, you know, work with somebody else. It's great, fine, if it's helpful. But anyway, she started to feel off about it. And why did I sign up? And wait, this isn't exactly what I want. And everything. And it took her months to kind of unpack what she'd gone through. And one of the things I said is, I said, well, you know how you can be sexually aroused, and then you go maybe further than you wanted to, and the next day you're like, oh no, why did I, oops, do that? And I said, did you feel like maybe there's a similar thing, like we're trying to arouse something in you? So emotionally you became turned on, aroused, and from that place you made a decision. And she said it was just like that. It was all the love bombing. It was the you're so important, and you're worth it, and you deserve it, and all of, you know, just lifting them. You're special, the people in the room. And this is, there's a number of things happening. It's seduction, first of all. It's seducing meaning leading away from, yeah? And it's also spell casting. There's a lot of spells being cast that are so subtle. But here's one of the spells that I see that gets people so messed up is equating what you make financially and your worth. And that happens in just a phrase, like charge what you deserve. And as soon as you say that, now those two things are connected. Oh, as soon as you have your head, it's like, oh yeah, charge what you're worth. You see what I'm saying? Because what they don't say, they'll equivocate. Oh, no. What I meant is charge what the work is worth. No, I promise if that's what you meant, that's what you would have said. What you said was charge what you are worth. And so then if you start going down that road, if you drink that Kool-Aid, the scorpion's tail of that is you're sitting in a seminar and they say, look, I know $10,000 is a lot for something like this, but aren't you worth it? Well, now you're hooked. So anyways, my friend and this colleague of mine, client, we talked about this for months, her unpacking what had gone on in that way. And I said, when you signed the contract for this thing, it was $11,000. So when you signed the contract, did they stop you and just go through it with you in detail? Here's the refund policy. Was there any slowing down? So, you know, I talked about three roles of marketing, and the first role being getting their attention. That's mostly word of mouth. Well, the second role of marketing is filtering, which means slowing down and making sure that people who aren't a fit don't buy. Mm. And that's the thing that counters charisma. Charisma is great, but the responsible use of charisma is that you don't let people make a decision based on that. You don't say, you know, you wield it responsibly. With great power comes great responsibility. You know, you say, so for example, there's a lot of things this could look like, but one of the things I've done is I've created these Are You Sure pages where somebody goes to click the button to sign up for a program. It takes them to a page and there's a video saying, hey, thanks for clicking the button. You wanted to pay you up, sign up for my program. I'm flattered that you did. And my guess is you didn't read the whole sales letter because it's long. I get it. I don't read them all either. But there's important stuff to see if this is a fit. You know, so for example, this program requires you to be on Facebook. It's going to take 5 hours a week of your time. It's going to ask that you really hustle, and this is mostly for service providers, not product makers, etc. And so I'll say, look, anyways, all that stuff is below. Cut and paste from the sales letter. Not the whole thing, but the filtering bits. And I'm going to ask that you actually read that right now. And then think about it for a few minutes. If it still feels like a fit, I'm thrilled to have you in the program. And if not, yeah. Or that could be a discovery call you do with people. But people think about in coaching these discovery calls, they treat them like sales calls. But yeah. What should be filtering calls, a call where the genuine, overt intention is, let's both see if this is a fit. I'm going to ask you some tough questions. You ask me some tough questions, and we'll see if we can in the end. Because otherwise it's charisma-based seduction. And you can get a lot of people, I mean, Simon Sinek said, these techniques work, but they can't get term loyalty. They can get somebody to buy or to vote, but they can't get you to be loyal and build a relationship long-term. In fact, they fundamentally undermine the basis of it, because here's the other thing to say about this. Connected to charisma, people show up, let's say, at these events in a certain level of desperation. Money's tight. It's a health crisis. They got the big C word diagnosis from the doctor. They've gone through one too many heartbreaks. The addiction finally hit rock bottom. You know, they're desperate. So if you get up on stage, and when people are desperate or vulnerable, there's one of two reactions that can come. There's the predator and then there's the protector. And the predator is the one that says, oh, you're weak, and so I take advantage of it. You fell asleep as the guard at this gate, so I'm going to sneak on through now. Whereas the protector would wake you up or sit guard until you wake up. And then, you know, so that's the moment you gain or lose all the trust, is when people are weak. If you take advantage of it, the trust is gone forever. Probably. And if you protect them in that moment, if you say, whoa, I see you're desperate. I know this is a very scary thing for you. I'm not sure I'm the best one to help you. And I'm not going to take your money unless I'm convinced I can help. So, like, put the credit card down for a second. Let's talk about this and see if this is really a fit. And if it is, I'd be so happy to help you. But if not, I might know some other people who can help you and I could refer you, and I'd rather that. So you see, that's what counters it, is this commitment to not preying upon people's weakness, which we've all done.
But this can also be whittled down to like really specific tactics as well. Like I'm thinking of a author that I talked to who did one of these big promotions with a, you know, a marketing partner, and they had, you know, promotion went great. We had 15,000 downloads, and of those, you know, X percent actually cracked open the book, a tiny percent. Of that percent, tiny percent had read through, and of that, a minuscule percent led to reviews, which was the whole point. So it's this type of thing where you're saying, I'm going to give away these books for free, and we're going to do it, this promotion, we're going to pay for it, and the whole, look at the 10,000 downloads, oh my gosh. And it's what you're talking about, though, which is, it wasn't a good fit. People grabbed free because you were giving free. They weren't the right readers. You misequated 10,000 people with like, I'm killing it. And then the end result, when you, if you actually have stats for it, you realize how ineffective it was. And it's that filtering thing that was, well, this is actually not effective. This is not a good fit. So it's interesting even trying to think about that at very specific marketing tactics, in addition to what you're talking about, which is like really big strategic stuff.
Yeah. Amen. It's, I mean, this is the whole goal is, you know, to another practical example. Let's say you're doing an intro workshop to fill a weekend workshop, that type of model. Well, of course, you want to fill up your weekend workshops. You want people to sign up. That's why you're doing the intros. So you'd want as many people as possible in the intro workshop to sign up. You know, the faster it happens, the more free time you have. So fine, that's fine. But the mistake that people make is they don't do the filtering on getting people into that intro, and then they sell them hard. Versus it would be better if it was a smaller group for that intro, but they were really the people, and then you share it. You know, there's just less. Part of this is people say, well, what do you mean it's better? Because you still spend the same 3 hours teaching, no matter how many people are there. So better to just have more people. But wait, this isn't just about you. Let's say you have 100 people and only 30 of them it's a fit for. So what does that mean? You just wasted 70 people's time. Let's do the math on 70 times 30, you know, or 3 hours rather. So that's 280 hours of human time that basically got squandered. So you know, there's a consequence to our marketing.
Well, there's another connection to that too, which is if you just had the 30 who were, to use a marketing term, highly qualified or warm leads or whatever the term is, if it's you and 30 people who are all a right fit, something special can happen in that room. If it's you and 30 people right fit and 70 people are wrong fit, nothing special is going to happen in that room.
It's true. And just the word of mouth. Here's the other long-term consequence. Just, you know, if we're going to go back to being just selfish about it. Okay. So 100 people leave that room. And people start talking, hey, did you go to that workshop? How was it? Some people say, what a waste of my time. Somebody else said, well, yeah, it was all right. Somebody else says, it was amazing. It was really good. So then they say, God, there's real mixed reviews, versus you get it down to 30. And they say, how was the workshop? That was the best thing I've ever been to. How was the workshop? Incredible. And everyone I talk to says it's amazing. This is a long game. I get it. That's the long game, is the word of mouth, the reputation is so consistently good that you never really hear anything bad. Why? Because the filtering has been so good.
I mean, sometimes it's the long game, but I think I'm totally agreeing with you. I'm thinking it's also this idea of like the anti-virality, this idea that, I mean, just yesterday, all the time I talk to writers like, oh yeah, I've got an email list. I mean, it's tiny, it's 100 people, it's 200 people. And I always try to like, you know, tell them how I think, which is like, that's great. Like, are they opening it? Are you getting feedback? Oh yeah, it's doing great. And I'm like, this is amazing, because I know a lot of people who have thousands, and it's an old list. There are, you know, it's just, there's something happening, but it's with a tiny percent. And maybe if you whittle down the 5,000 the last time you're engaged, it might come down to 120 people are the highly engaged. So it's just neat to, I hope for the listeners to even realize that too, which is like, you could be in the best spot with a very small list because you have an engaged list.
Yeah. And, you know, and also to tie this back to the workshop example, yeah, let's say there's 100 people and let's say you're trying to answer as many questions as you can. Well, wouldn't it be better to be answering the questions of the people who are a fit and helping them? And if you're answering, you know, for people who aren't a fit, you're never going to hit it out of the park with them because it's fundamentally not a fit.
Yeah.
So way better to, yeah, cater and take such good care of those people that they become, you know, advocates of your work and just tell everyone they know. And, you know, the other thing I want to say about that ebook thing is, I think one of the, to go back to your original question of the misguided drive, one of the misguided drives is this focus on what we're giving instead of the focus on what they're receiving. You know, the focus on what they're getting from it. And this even shows up in marketing sales copy where it's, you know, sign up for this and you'll get, I'll give you this, this, this. But the better way to say it would be you'll get this, this, and this. And so the same thing, if the focus is on, well, I just give so much information on the workshop. Great, you give a lot of information, but is any of it landing? You know, it's like irrigating a field. The slower the water drips in, the deeper it goes. If it goes too fast, it just skids off the surface, you know, and it's not good. That's flooding, and now you've lost your topsoil. So there's a similar commitment of, okay, how do I make sure that people really get the results they came for? Not just that I give them, you know, there's three things people need when they're suffering, I think. First is empathy. It's just life is hard. I'm so sorry. Second, context. That's the information piece. And that's very helpful for people to just know, where am I stuck? Where am I lost? What are the maps? Okay, now I see it. That's a real blessing when you don't have it. But then the third is guidance. People, and that's the kind of more personalized one-on-one that people need. They need some hand-holding because information is great, but people then still have to translate it into their own situations, which I'm a why I'm a fan of just giving so much information away, because what it tends to do then is people say, wow, I see what you're saying is true. I like the map, but how does this relate to me? I can't seem to translate this to my own language. And then that's, you know, I think where we can be very helpful for people. You know, the other thing I wanted to throw on about charisma is this, because you're right, there are so many different styles of charisma. I know people who are charismatic in a way that it's like this salesy, like, hey, I got a deal for you. Come on, come on, come on. Hey, hey, so just give me 5 minutes, you know? And it's actually very charming the way they do it. I don't find it slimy. It's just like, okay, 5 minutes, go, give me your pitch. What do you got? Because it's so authentic for them. So to me, rather than...
Is that like the magician I see on like a Penn and Teller show, they have like a game show where they say, I'm going to trick you. I'm going to show you these cards. I'm going to lie to you and I'm going to whatever. And like right up front, and you sort of like them right away. Cause you're like, okay, there's no game here. They're telling me what they're going to do. Is it like that?
I like that. Yeah. It's to me, cause people often think, well, I need to be confident, but often this trying to be confident turns into a posturing, turns into a puffing up. That's kind of fake versus comfortable in your own skin. And so some people have this nerdy kind of charisma, and some people have this badass charisma, I don't give a fuck, you know. And there's lots of different ways that you can be charismatic, but I think the roots of it are you're comfortable in your own skin, and this causes people to just relax around you in a way that's very sweet.
So you talked about the three roles in marketing. We got to the second one.
Yeah, so the first one is we get their attention. That's the kind of obvious gimme. Then we filter. We make sure that only the people who are a good fit get through. But then this is what's interesting. You could get people's attention. You could do all the filtering. And people say, wow, that is relevant to me. I trust you. That is a real good bargain. And they still don't buy. How could it be? It's because there's this risk. People perceive a risk of taking that first step. So the third role of marketing is that we lower the risk of taking that initial step. And so there's lots of ways to do this. That could be guarantees. This can be established by reputation. This can be just built relationship over time. This can be the free videos or podcasts or blog posts where people just get to know you over time in a safe way. But whatever we can do to lower the risk is a big deal, because I think sometimes we forget with the things that we're offering, that there's financially there's a risk. There's a lot that can be very confronting to people. And so anything you can do to make that first step, because that's the hardest step for them to, you know, read the first book of an author, or to go to a first workshop, or to buy the first product. That's why, I mean, this is not a novel idea, but the free samples at the bakery, you know, the grocery store, the free perfume samples, take the puppy home for 30 days for a week to see if your kid gets along with it. It's based on this understanding, like, of course it's a risk, and you as the person buying are genuinely taking on some of the risks. So let me take on the risk for you. Mm-hmm. Let me, like a street performer to me is one of the best examples. They do the whole show in advance, and then at the very end, you only pay if you think it was a good show. So they have to actually inspire you to give. They are genuinely taking on the whole risk, and more than all the risk of the show. But that's how they get crowds too. Because I saw one street performer do this where they said, you know what? I'm not busting my ass out here in the hot sun. So put in half right now what you're going to put in. And they put a blindfold on and said, put half, and everyone left.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. It's the rookie mistakes of the young.
Can I tell you the one? I mean, I just love this story. I remember seeing this. I saw them twice because they kept doing it for years. Street performers, Washington Square Park in New York. And I see three guys, very charismatic. They were going to do this crazy jump, you know, this absurd thing. And they're building it up and building it up. And they're really charismatic. And the crowd's getting bigger. And you're in Manhattan. And they do the collect the money thing before the big event. And they're hyping up, this guy's going to kill himself doing this. Yeah. And then they collected the money. And then it's the most genius thing I've ever seen. The last guy giving a buck, they're like, where are you from? And he goes, Brooklyn. Half the crowd goes nuts. Then he taunts the audience. He's like, you going to let Brooklyn get this? They easily doubled their money doing the thing. New Jersey, Queens, the whole thing. And it was, I just stood there with my jaw on the floor at how the pride, like they worked with this. And they did this. They did the stunt. It was spectacular. And that's, I think, really critical too. There was a payoff. Yeah. And they built the excitement. It was just so interesting to see how that worked and how they played with something that in a million years I never would have thought of, is like you said, like it almost seems like they're collecting at the wrong time. But then when they had all the money, they found this really intriguing personal way to double their money and to get people to feel great about it. It was just so, I'm still fascinated by it. This is like 20, I think I saw them like 20 years ago, then maybe again 15 years ago. And I was just like blown away.
I think what I love about it is it's very playful. You know, because of course there's no pressure. I mean, people are they can't force anyone to do anything.
Yeah.
Then they make a game of it. And so people get to, and we're talking like $5, $10. The stakes are so low. So it's a very low stakes, fun game. People can throw in a buck or a quarter or whatever. But, you know, here's the thing, and I'll tie this back to the story I was sharing about Amsterdam, is let's say they done, because I was wondering where the story was going to go. Let's say there was no payoff. They collect all the money, and then they say, actually, well, we're just going to get our stuntman to do it, and they get a little puppet, and the puppet does the jump or whatever. The crowd would feel so betrayed. I mean, maybe kind of laugh, but then what would happen is they'd be way less likely to watch other street performers. Because they say, oh, man, you know, they just build it up and they don't do anything. No, he's going to climb this ladder. He's not going to climb the ladder. You know, they become cynical and mistrustworthy of the whole industry of street performing. And so when I went to Amsterdam and this guy who ripped off my website hosts the workshop, I start getting emails before. I got a couple of emails from people and they saying, so what's going to happen in the workshop? And so I know there's some question behind it. But I said, well, it goes from 10 to 6. Yeah. So from 10 to 1 o'clock, I'll be talking about marketing. And then from 1 to 2:30, we'll take an hour and a half for lunch. And then from 2:30 to 6, I'll talk more about marketing. But I imagine there's a reason you're asking me this. Is this just you selling your coaching programs? And so the thing I want people to hear in this is they didn't make that up. That is because some of my American colleagues went over and did that. Mm. Big promise. It's going to be a big jump. But in this case, the big jump, you're going to learn these three things. Come to this workshop. You're going to get so much out of it. But of course, when they come, it's a bit of a bait and switch. The first big chunk is them telling their life story and trying to build rapport and connection. And then the content is less than promised. And then it pivots at the end to say, if you want to really learn this, you've got to sign up for the full coaching program. And that's where you're really going to get this, even though there was no indication that anything was going to be held back. And so then that hurts me. You know, this. So now I show up, and I'm dealing with the suspicion and the fallout of this. And so if I behave badly in the marketplace, it reflects badly on all my colleagues too. And this is a much bigger picture than just our narrow, immediate sense of profit. Because if all of us in our industry, and I think this was the original purpose of the guilds and unions, was if, you know, if you had a blacksmith and they really screwed up and they were a part of this guild, the guild would say, we'll take care of it. We'll fix it for you. You know, because our pride in our profession is so high. And it wouldn't go well for you if you'd screwed people over, because they'll say, you're part of this this brotherhood, this fraternity of blacksmiths. And so everything you do reflects on us. You know, reputation, it's interesting. When people think about, I just had this thought the other day. Reputation is primarily about food. That when we conduct ourselves in a beautiful way in the world, it feeds, I mean, depending what you believe ancestrally, but it feeds the ones we come from. They get to look down on us and say, oh, look at that one down there. And it's a kind of food for them to see us living that way. And then it also feeds the future generations, you know, because we can all think of somebody who we love so much. And if 20 years from now, their son or daughter showed up on our door and said, I need help, you would just say, whatever you need. You know, your father, your mother was there for me. You come in. How can I help? You know, and you just wouldn't even, you do everything for them. So this is a way that their parents or grandparents fed them. But then it also feeds your community in the moment. And so that if you go to another community and you represent, you know, I think in Scotland, the clans, you knew if you went to another clan, you represented your whole clan primarily. Before you represented yourself, you represented them. And so if you behaved well, it fed your clan, you know, present time, the esteem of the clan went up, which made everything easier for that clan. People would trust you, do better deals with you, and be more generous with you. So people, when people think about reputation as just a personal thing, people become very fearful. But if you think about it as a manner of feeding your colleagues and your community, you become very careful. And the distinction between those two words is important. Fearful meaning full of fear, if it's about you. But careful meaning you're full of care, if it's about other people and not primarily about you, actually. And if everyone in the industry conducts themselves well, you know, the whole industry swells with that.
I love that. I can't think of a better way to sort of end the conversation. I will say, though, is there anything else that you wanted to say on this that I haven't asked about? Do you feel like we have to close the loop on?
Maybe just to tie back to some of those things in the beginning, just to consider this. What if you're supposed to be terrible at marketing yourself? And the point then of marketing becomes about creating the structures and systems that make it easy for other people to spread the word about you. What if instead of struggling to find clients, the whole purpose of marketing was to create the structures and systems that would make it easy for people to find you and feel safe in approaching you? And what if marketing wasn't about trying to convince anyone or seduce anyone or persuade anyone to buy, but was just about you sharing what you have with the people for whom you think it would be a fit? It feels so different to do it from that way.
Ted, thank you so much for taking the time. I love talking with you about this. So thank you so much. You can find Tad Hargrave at marketingforhippies.com. On Twitter and Instagram, at Tad Hargrave, that is H-A-R-G-R-A-V-E. He's also got a Facebook page and a YouTube channel. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me on social media at Dan Blank and on my website, wegrowmedia.com. Thank you so much for listening until the end.